get into the message. In the series on the origin of false religion, which we have been covering, we are now dealing with the origin of false Christianity. Last time we covered Simon Magus, what the Bible and history records concerning him, and there is a surprisingly good amount of material on him in the old Encyclopedia Britannica that we read from. We saw also from Acts chapter 8 that Simon was a Samaritan sorcerer. You read that in Acts 8 and verses somewhere around 8 to 10, somewhere in that area. But in verse 10 of Acts 8, he was referred to as, it says, he was regarded by the least to the greatest as the great power of God. He was a sorcerer. He was, as a result, a great religious leader and had bewitched the people of Samaria for quite some time, it says in that section of Acts 8. And he was considered the great power of God. Now, being a Samaritan, he was a leading teacher of the Samaritan religion. If you remember what that was, we covered that in a sermon by itself when we covered the Samaritans back in 2 Kings 17 and how they came to be. And they were individuals who had been brought into Samaria after the king of Assyria had taken the Israelites captive. He cleaned out the area of Israel, the house of Israel, took them into captivity into Assyria. An empty land does not produce tribute, so he brought in individuals from Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, where Babylon was, the areas of Babylonia, and brought them in, if you remember that sermon. And the Samaritan religion of that day, because they superstitiously were afraid of the god of the land, they wanted to learn about the god of the land to placate him. And so they ended up mixing Israelite traditions and customs and history with their own Babylonian paganism, as we saw that time in that sermon. We also saw in Acts chapter 8 that Simon Magus, Magus is singular for magi, which means sorcerer, Simon was baptized by Philip. But he was not converted. He didn't receive God's Spirit. In fact, as you read a little bit later on, after Peter came down with others of the apostles, he tried to actually buy an apostleship. He tried to purchase with money, the ability to lay hands on people for the receiving of God's Spirit. And so that's what the apostles were doing. And so he tried to buy that authority for himself. But from the time of his baptism, he claimed to be a Christian. He was not converted. He didn't become a true Christian, but he was baptized by Philip, and he claimed to be a Christian from then on. Several early Catholic Church historians, just to name a few, Justin Martyr and Irenaeus, Eusebius, and Cyril of Jerusalem, record that Simon went to Rome during the days of Claudius Caesar, Emperor Claudius, who was Caesar in Rome from 41 to 54 AD. During the days of Claudius, Simon went to Rome. History records that. History also records the impact that Simon had when he went to Rome. In Rome, Simon bewitched the people of Rome. He also bewitched the members of the Senate, the Roman Senate. And he also had a considerable impact on Claudius himself, because Claudius petitioned to have a statue erected to Simon that he erected and set in the river Tiber. And he had the inscription placed upon the statue, Simoni Deo Sancto in Latin, which means to Simon the Holy God. So he was considered by Claudius, because he had the statue built, to be a great religious leader. But his brand of Christianity that he taught looked more like Roman paganism than it did like Christianity. What Simon had done, because he taught his brand of Christianity, was to make his religion a mixture of Babylonian paganism with Israelite religious customs and history, and he added Christian ideas and customs and names to what he taught, since he claimed to be a Christian. So it was a mixture of all three. So Simon went to Rome teaching this brand of Christianity with the Babylonian paganism, Israelite ideas, and Christian ideas. That's why the Christianity that he taught began to, well, probably, we don't know exactly when, he may have been observing that day from the beginning, December 25th, because that was the ancient day for the worship of the rebirth of the sun god, which is what he worshipped, a part of his religion. Also, he worshipped Ishtar, or Easter, and so that became a part of the Christian tradition, simply putting Christ's name on various pagan practices that he already observed, that the Romans already observed. The question is, how did Simon's brand of Christianity take root in Rome and supplant or replace the true Christianity of God? Because there was a church of God in Rome. Paul wrote to it. We have it in the Bible, the book or the letter to the Roman church. Those were true Christians. How did Simon's brand of Christianity supplant or replace that true Christianity of God? And this is what we'll begin covering today. As we read last time, several church historians list Peter the Apostle as the first bishop of Rome. We read that from this book, actually. History of the Christian Church by Philip Schaff gives a list of the Roman emperors, and the lists also of the bishops of Rome, which came to be called the Popes of Rome. A bishop of Rome was the original name for the Popes of Rome. And they list the first bishop of Rome, or the first pope of the Roman Catholic Church, as Peter the Apostle. And they give his dates for being the bishop of Rome from 42 A.D. to 67 A.D., or for a total of 25 years. Those 25 years from 42 A.D. start from the second year of Claudius Caesar, so after Simon went to Rome. So it started in the second year of Claudius Caesar, and the 25 years of his being the bishop of Rome ended 1 year before Nero died, who became emperor after Claudius had died. But we need to understand that the Apostle Peter was not the first pope or bishop of Rome. That belief is a gross error, totally untrue. And there are several internal biblical facts that show this is not true. We need to understand that, because much of the world, the Catholic world, believes that Peter was the first pope. We have St. Peter's Basilica, if you go to the Vatican, and that's the church that is associated with the Vatican, St. Peter's Basilica. But Peter was not the first pope of Rome, and you can prove that from the Bible itself. First point, and there will be 6 points. Wish there were seven, but there are only six that I can come up with. Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles and not Peter. The Roman church was a Gentile congregation. Paul was the one entrusted with the responsibility of taking the gospel, the good news, the truth of God, to the Gentile world, to the uncircumcised world. So Paul was the one. Paul wrote the letter to the Romans, not Peter. Peter was not there. Over here in Galatians chapter 2, we read the account where Paul went up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders that were there to consider a specific subject. Let's read this first, and then we'll get into some of the background for this visit and this what came to be a ministerial conference to decide and determine a certain truth. Here in Galatians chapter 2, verse 4, "And because of false brethren, unawares brought in, who came in privately to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus," this is Paul writing, "that they might bring us into bondage, whom we gave place by subjection, no, not for an hour, that the truth of the gospel might continue with you." Again, Paul writing to the church of God at Galatia, actually pronounced Galatia, but we always call it Galatia. So if I said Galatia, most of us would go and not know what we're talking about. But if you talk to Mr. Johnson, David Johnson, did he call it Galatia when you were taking? Yes. So most of us would call it Galatia, but it's apparently correctly pronounced Galatia. But Galatians, it's not Galatians. We call it Galatians anyway. "But those who seem to be somewhat, whatever they were, it makes no matter to me. God accepts no man's person, for they who seem to be somewhat in conference added nothing to me." In these three verses from 4 through 6, Paul is referencing the false brethren, not the apostles. He's referencing the false brethren. They didn't add anything to Paul, but they were false brethren. Now, the background for this, what Paul was doing in Jerusalem and in this conference, Acts 15 Jerusalem conference, pick it up in verse 1. "This conference in Jerusalem took place in 49 AD, we believe. 49 AD. Or about 18 years after the church began. So 18 years from 31 AD, Pentecost. We are now seeing Paul go to Jerusalem to discuss or to have a matter determined whether circumcision was required for spiritual salvation, physical circumcision. Pick it up in verse 1, chapter 15. "And certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved." So they were teaching that physical circumcision was required for spiritual salvation. Now, Paul had not been teaching that. He had most likely been taught by Jesus Christ himself for the 3 years that he was in Arabia that physical circumcision was not what was wanted. God has always wanted circumcision of the heart, a changed heart. "When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. And being brought on their way by the church, they passed through Phinehas and Samaria, declaring the conversion of the Gentiles, and they caused great joy unto all the brethren. And when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and elders, and they declared all things that God had done with them. But there rose up certain of the sect of the Pharisees which believed." Now, please take note, these aren't the false brethren. These are two different groups of people. Because false brethren were false brethren. They weren't truly converted. They were false brethren. These were Pharisees which believed. So these were people, these were individuals from the sect of the Pharisees that strict sect of the Jews, but they were believers. Now, they had not grown in knowledge because what they're going to discuss here had not yet been determined, that physical circumcision was not necessary. The Pharisees, of course, being from their Jewish background for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, believed in circumcision. In fact, circumcision was a sign of the covenant that God gave to Abraham, if you remember, and not just the old covenant. And so they considered physical circumcision very important because they had not grown yet. It had not been revealed yet. It hadn't been determined yet that physical circumcision wasn't necessary. So please realize there were two different groups of people. There was a group of false brethren who were teaching things that the same thing that the Pharisees were, but one false brethren, one were believers, two different groups, but they were teaching the same thing. That it was needful to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses. And the apostles and elders came together for to consider this matter. This is the first time that it was actually dealt with as a ministerial conference to determine that issue. And when there had been much disputing, Peter rose up and said unto them, Men and brethren, you know how that a good while ago God made choice among us that the Gentiles by my mouth should hear the word of the gospel and believe. And remember, what he's talking about is Peter going to Cornelius. And Cornelius was converted. He was totally uncircumcised. And Peter had gone through quite a bit of dissension among the Jews himself because he went to an uncircumcised individual. And God, and he told them, how could I refuse baptizing them because God gave them his spirit like he gave to us? So how could I refuse baptism because God had already, you know, given them his spirit? But the first Gentile was baptized by Peter, but Peter did not go to the Gentiles. Please also notice, if Peter had been the first bishop of Rome for 25 years, Paul went up to Jerusalem and found Peter there. He was not in Rome, pastoring the Roman church. He was in Jerusalem with the apostles and elders. Didn't say that Peter came up as well. You know, Paul came up to discuss this situation. So what we have is that Paul comes up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders in this conference to decide whether physical circumcision was necessary for salvation. That had not yet been determined. Christ had taught Paul that it wasn't necessary. And that's why Paul didn't teach it to the Gentiles. But the Jews had not yet understood that. The Jewish Christians, the Jews who had been converted, did not understand that. The decision at this conference was that it was not necessary. Circumcision of the flesh was not necessary for salvation. What God has always wanted was circumcision of the heart. And we see that back here in Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy 10, and starting in verse 12. Says, And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your life. You can read that in the New Testament as well. That's what God has wanted all along, for people to truly love him, to love his words, to live by every word that proceeds out of his mouth. That's something that all of us need to examine ourselves and ask ourselves, do I really love God or not? Do I really, truly love God or not? or do I really love what I want to do and will do what God says if it doesn't conflict with what I want to do? There's a lot of that. There's too much of that. And God is judging, God is examining the heart. He knows what comes out of the heart. Verse 13, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you this day for your good. Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens is the Lord your God, the earth also and all that therein is. Only the Lord has a delight in your fathers to love them, and he chose their seed after them, even you above all people, as it is this day. Circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart, and be no more stiff-necked. That's what God has wanted from the beginning. If Adam and Eve had have eaten of the tree of life instead of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we wouldn't have had a lot of problems that we've had. They would have had access to the Spirit of God from that time forward. They could have been converted, could have grown, but it was a free will choice. And they, under the influence of Satan, yielded to what he had to say. Israel, they were not given sacrifices for sin in the beginning. There was no Levitical priesthood in the beginning. The Levitical priesthood was ordained after they broke the covenant that God made with them at Mount Sinai. We've entered into a covenant with God at baptism. Are we living up to that? We have promised God to love him with all of our heart, mind, life, and strength, and our neighbors ourselves. Are we living up to that covenant and that agreement? At baptism, circumcision of the heart took place. Our past sins were forgiven. Are we striving to keep that way? Circumcise the foreskin of your hearts and be no more stiff-necked. For the Lord your God is God of gods, Lord of lords, a great God, a mighty and terrible, which regards not persons nor takes reward. He does execute judgment of the fatherless and the widow and loves the stranger and giving him food and raiment. Love you, therefore, the stranger, for you were strangers in Egypt. Turn over here to Colossians. But God, when he enters into covenant, it's a very serious thing. Colossians chapter 2. And we need to examine ourselves. Are we living up to the covenant that we made? Colossians 2. Now, thankfully, God is very merciful, very compassionate. He understands we are but dust. But he also understands he's given us access to power to change. And he wants us to use that power, not ignore it. He understands how weak and frail we are, but with the power of his Spirit, we can change. Colossians 2:10. And you are complete in him. Again, reading out of the King James Version, the old King James, not the new King James. You are complete in him. When we receive God's Spirit, we are complete. Before that, we're not all there. And that's true. Once we have God's Spirit in us, we now have power within us to control the mind. Before that, we don't have all the power we need to control the mind. We may be able to control our actions, but we still don't control the mind. You know, people can learn to count to 10 before getting angry, right? And not verbalize their anger. But does that mean that the mind is totally under control? But with God's Spirit, we can begin controlling the mind so that we don't have that negative spirit develop. It's a matter of growth. It's a matter of crying out to God for the strength and in time to actually begin having right thoughts come into the mind before the wrong thoughts do. Wouldn't that be wonderful? To never have a wrong thought again. That would be beautiful. But God wants to see us working at that, working toward that. You are complete in Him. Once you have God's Spirit in you, that makes us complete. Which is the head, and you're complete in Him, which is the head of all principality and power, speaking of Jesus Christ, in whom also you are circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, that circumcision of the heart, forgiveness of sins, and putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. And when did that take place? Buried with Him in baptism, wherein also you are risen with Him through the faith of the operation of God, who has raised Him from the dead. And you being dead in your sins and in the uncircumcision of your flesh, has He quickened together with Him, having forgiven you all trespasses. So at baptism, circumcision of the heart takes place. And that's what God has wanted. Now let's continue with Galatians. Galatians 2 and verse 7. Galatians 2, 7. Breaking into where we left off. But contrariwise, when they saw that the gospel of the uncircumcision was committed unto me, and the gospel of the circumcision was unto, or as the gospel of the circumcision was unto Peter. So, in conference, they recognized that Paul had been called to bring the gospel to the Gentiles, to the uncircumcised, as Peter had been called to take the gospel to those circumcised, to the Jews and those of Israel who were circumcised. Verse 8, for he that wrought effectually in Peter to the apostleship of the circumcision, the same was, now, New King James and perhaps some of the more modern translations do not put the word mighty in there. Does anybody else have mighty? If you have an old King, do you have an old King James? Okay, that's, scratch it, because it shouldn't be there. It's not in the original Greek. In the New King James, if you have a New King James, mighty isn't there. But in the Old King James, it is. And it's there because the King James translators were trying to elevate Paul above Peter. If you read it the way they have translated it here, it says, for he that wrought effectually in Peter to the apostleship of the circumcision, the same was mighty in me. Which means it was more in Paul than he was in Peter. But that's not what it says. Paul was saying there was equality. For he that wrought effectually in Peter to the apostleship of the circumcision, the same was in me toward the Gentiles. Not mighty in me, but the same was simply in me. So scratch mighty if you've got an old King James. The New King James does not put mighty there, and perhaps some of the more modern translations don't. But the point is, Peter was the apostle to the circumcised, to the Jews and other Israelites. Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles. And when, verse 9, when James, Cephas, Peter, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given unto me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, that we should go unto the heathen, and they unto the circumcision. The point is, Paul was responsible for all Gentile congregations. He was the apostle to the uncircumcised or to the Gentiles. The Roman congregation was a Gentile congregation. It was under Paul's jurisdiction. It was under Paul's responsibility. You see in Romans chapter 1, Romans 1, and in verse 13. Now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oft times I purpose to come unto you, Paul, chapter 1, verse 1, Paul is writing this. Now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oft times I purpose to come unto you, and was restrained or hindered hitherto, that I might have some fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles. So Rome was a Gentile church. I want to have fruit among you as among other Gentiles. Now, in most congregations that Paul oversaw as the apostle to the uncircumcised, there were some Jews. There were always some Jews in those congregations, but the bulk of the congregation were Gentile in nature. They were the uncircumcised. The Roman congregation was a Gentile congregation, and Paul had the responsibility of carrying the gospel, as we read in Galatians 2, carrying the gospel to the uncircumcised, to the Gentiles. Peter would not have been the bishop of Rome for 25 years. Peter would not have even been there, because it was Paul's jurisdiction, Paul's responsibility, and Peter recognized that. You will go to the uncircumcised, and we will go to the circumcised. That's what you read and read in Galatians 2. Second point, and these won't be as long. Peter was a Jew, correct? We understand that. What had Emperor Claudius done? Acts 18, starting in verse 1. After these things, Paul departed from Athens, came to Corinth, and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome, and came unto them. Priscilla and Aquila had left Italy, left Rome, because Claudius had banned all Jews from Rome. Claudius had given this edict around 50 AD. This was after the Jerusalem conference, though Claudius didn't have any knowledge of the Jerusalem conference. But this was around 50 AD. You find that in Roman history. There is no record of this ban ever being lifted. So in 50 AD, Claudius banned all Jews from Rome. And since Peter was a Jew, he would have been subject to that ban. He would have been forced out of Rome. So he couldn't have been there from 42 to 67 AD. There is no record of that ban being lifted. But it wasn't enforced, obviously, after Claudius' death in 54 AD. Because Jews returned to Rome, as we'll see later. But for those 4 years of Claudius' reign before he died, Jews had been banished. So Peter could not have been there continuously from 42 to 67 AD for 25 years. The point here is that Peter, being a Jew, would have been expelled from Rome just as Priscilla and Aquila had been expelled. So he couldn't have been there for those 25 years continuously. But the fact is, Peter was never there as the Bishop of Rome. Tradition has him dying in Rome, but that may have been the only time that he went there. around 68 AD when he died. So, second point was, Jews were banned by Claudius. Peter was a Jew, so he couldn't have been there continuously from 42 to 67 AD. Third, Peter spent much of his time in Jerusalem and Babylon. Why? Because there were large concentrations of Jews, and he was the apostle to the circumcised. As we saw in the Jerusalem conference, Peter was there in Jerusalem at that time. He was one of the apostles in Jerusalem. So he spent his time in Jerusalem and also in Babylon. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 13. This is the first letter we have from Peter, and he's writing this letter from Babylon. The church that is at Babylon, elect together with you, salutes you, as does Marcus, that's John Mark, young John Mark, my son. Greet one another with a holy kiss of charity, with a kiss of charity. Elsewhere it's called the holy kiss, but it's like the French kissing on each cheek, most likely. So, why is he sending greetings from the church at Babylon? Well, that's where he was. Why would he have been there? Well, there was a large Jewish population in Babylon. Where had the Jews been taken captive when the house of Judah went into captivity? The house of Israel went into captivity into Assyria, and 125 years later, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took the house of Judah captive, emptied the land, and brought them to Babylon. Three stages of captivity. We wouldn't understand that from Scripture. But the Jews were taken captive to Babylon. That's when Daniel and his three companions were taken to Babylon, and so on. After the Medo-Persian Empire conquered Babylon, the king of Persia, who was Cyrus, permitted the Jews who wished to return to Palestine to return. And you read that in Ezra and Nehemiah. In Ezra and Nehemiah, you see the Jews, many Jews, not everyone though, returning to Palestine, returning to Jerusalem, to rebuild the city and to rebuild the temple. However, not all Jews returned. Many Jews stayed in Babylon, now conquered by the Medes and the Persians, and were there in Babylonia and in Persia, which is modern-day Iran. We know that when you read the book of Esther. Esther is written during the days of the Medes and the Persians ruling that area, and Esther actually became queen of Persia because she married the Persian king, Artaxerxes. But during her time there, Haman tried to have the Jews destroyed, and his plot was thwarted. So there was a large population of Jews in that area, in Babylon, and that's why Peter also went there to take the gospel to the circumcision. So he would not have been in Rome for 25 years, from 42 to 67 AD. Third point then. Next is the fourth point, Romans chapter 1. Romans 1 and verse 11. Paul writes, says, For I long to see you, Paul writing to the church of God at Rome, I long to see you that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end you may be established. Now it is believed that Paul wrote the letter to the Romans from 57 to 58 AD, somewhere in that period of time, 57 to 58 AD, which is some 15 to 16 years after Peter is supposed to have become the bishop of Rome. So Let that sink in. Okay. Some 15 to 16 years after Peter is supposed to have become the pastor of the church at Rome, and Paul writes to the Roman congregation saying, I wish to impart to you some spiritual gift that you may be established. Because Peter isn't doing a very good job, he hasn't established you yet. That would be a slap in the face if you see what I mean here. If Peter was actually the pastor of the Roman congregation, and Paul says, I'm longing to be there because after 15 or 16 years, you're still not established in the truth yet. Doesn't make much sense, does it? Because Peter wasn't there, and they had not had an apostolic visit yet. Paul longed to see them. He wanted to see them. He purposed to come, verse 13, many times, but he was hindered. That he could have some fruit among them as among other Gentiles. So he longed to see them, to get them established. They probably had elders, but they did not have an apostolic visit. Peter was not there. So, fifth point, Romans 15. Romans 15 and verse 20. Excuse me. It says, yea, Paul again writing, yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named. Paul didn't want to teach anywhere where Christ was already taught, lest I should build upon another man's foundation. Now, if Peter had been the pastor of the Roman congregation from 42 AD forward, and this is written in 57, 58 AD, he says, I don't go where Christ has already preached. Now, you're assuming that Peter had not preached about Christ for 16 to 17 years, or that Peter wasn't there. Okay. Because I should not build upon another man's foundation. If Peter had been there, he would have already made a foundation of teaching the gospel, and he wasn't. Okay? So, again, internal proof that Peter was not there as the pastor of the Roman congregation. Finally, in sixth point, in chapter 16, over 30 people Paul sends greetings to, most of them by name, Phoebe, Priscilla, Aquila, and notice Priscilla and Aquila have returned to Rome by this time, 57, 58 AD. They've returned to Rome, and he sends greeting to them and the church that was in their house, verse 5. So Priscilla and Aquila either had a big house or it was a small church in their house, but could be either, we don't know. They may have had a big house. But that wasn't the only congregation meeting because there were all these other people. But you can have a small church too. I remember the Memphis congregation when United started back in 1995. The Memphis congregation started out, and Memphis used to be a congregation of 550 people. Started out with four. Met in Lorraine Hee's home because she could handle four people pretty well. By the time we got there, I think it was about six or seven or eight at most. It wasn't because we left San Antonio in 97. But then it grew up to about 30. People moved in. Then it went down to three. Vivian, myself, and my daughter. So we disbanded the Memphis congregation because it was just, we could meet on our own home and take care of ourselves. So we disbanded the Memphis congregation. Then people started moving back in again. And so it grew back up. And it's about 20 or so now again. But anyway, Paul sends greetings to over 30 people, and most of them by name, but Peter isn't mentioned once. And if Peter had been the pastor of the congregation, and you send greetings to all these people, but you don't mention Peter, your fellow apostle and pastor of the church, that doesn't make sense. Does not make sense. But it does make sense if you know and realize that Peter wasn't there. Peter was never the pastor of the Roman congregation. He was not the first pope of Rome. Now, there may have been a Simon, Peter, Father Simon, who may have been the first pope of Rome, but it wasn't Simon Peter. It was Father Simon, who was already recognized as a great religious leader by the Roman people at that time. But how did Simon's brand of Christianity get a foothold and grow in Rome and replace the Church of God, the truth of God? Simon Magus went to Rome. We know that. History records that. He was accepted as a great religious leader by the emperor, by the Roman Senate, and the people of Rome, who were all pagans and worshipped on many of the same days that Simon did, worshipped many of the same gods by different names that Simon did. But what happened to the true Christians in Rome? We learn about this from the persecution of the Christians in the days of Nero, who was emperor in Rome after Claudius. The following is, I'm going to read excerpts from this book, History of the Christian Church. This is volume 1, Apostolic Christianity from AD 1 to AD 100. So, covers the time of Claudius, Nero, and so on. This is starting on page 378 under the subsection called Nero. This is the beginning of Nero's reign. The first of these imperial persecutions, and it's dealing with various persecutions that developed, it's actually in the chapter called Great Tribulation. But the first of these imperial persecutions with which the martyrdom of Peter and Paul, that's the tradition is that Peter died in Rome around 68-69 AD. Martyrdom of Peter and Paul is connected by ecclesiastical tradition, and he makes that clear, by ecclesiastical tradition, took place in the 10th year of Nero's reign. That's when the persecution began, or the 64 AD is when Nero's persecution of the Christians began, 64 AD. By the instigation of that very emperor whom Paul, as a Roman citizen, had appealed from the Jewish tribunal. And if you remember reading in Acts, Paul said, "I appeal to Caesar." Well, the Caesar at that time was Nero. And he went to Rome as he appealed to Caesar. Now, the Bible covers his first imprisonment. It does not cover his second. The book of Acts ends after his first imprisonment. 2 Timothy is the letter that Paul wrote during his second, or at the end of his second imprisonment, when he was martyred, when he was put to death. You know, my departure is at hand, if you wish. I'm ready to die. I fought a good fight, I've kept the faith, and so on. It was, however, not a strictly religious persecution like those under the later emperors, and we'll read that as time goes on. It originated in a public calamity which was wantonly charged upon the innocent Christians. A greater contrast can hardly be imagined than that between Paul, one of the purest and noblest of men, and Nero, one of the basest and vilest of tyrants. The glorious first 5 years of Nero's reign, 54 to 59 AD, under the wise guidance of Seneca and Burrus, make the other 9 years, 59 to 68, only more hideous by contrast. We read his life with mingled feelings of contempt for his folly and horror of his wickedness. He heaped crime upon crime until he became a proverbial monster of iniquity, speaking of Nero. The murder of his brother Britannicus, so Nero murdered a lot of his family. He murdered Britannicus, his brother. He murdered his mother, Agrippina. His wives, Octavia and Poppaea. He murdered his teacher, Seneca, and many eminent Romans. Was fitly followed by his suicide in his 32nd year of his age. So Nero committed suicide at age 32. With Nero, the family of Julius Caesar ignominiously perished, and the empire became the prize of successful soldiers and adventurers. Now, concerning the fire in Rome, and now Philip, this history is written in 1910, so you've got to understand the English being used. It's 1910 English. The conflagration, we wouldn't talk about the conflagration in Rome today. For such a demon in human shape, the murder of a crowd of innocent Christians was pleasant sport. The occasion of the hellish spectacle was a fearful conflagration of Rome, the most destructive and disastrous that ever occurred in history. It broke out in the night between the 18th and 19th of July among the wooden shops in the southeastern end of the great circus near the Palatine Hill. Lashed by the wind, it defied all exertions of the firemen and soldiers and raged with unabated fury for 7 nights and 6 days. Then it burst out again in another part near the Field of Mars, and in 3 days more laid waste to 2 other districts of the city. The calamity was incalculable. Only 4 of the 14 regions in which the city was divided remained uninjured. 3, including the whole interior city, from the circus to the Esquiline Hill, were a shapeless mass of ruins. The remaining 7 were more or less destroyed. Venerable temples, monumental buildings of the royal, republican, and imperial times, the richest creations of Greek art, which had been collected for centuries, were turned into dust and ashes. Men and beasts perished in the flames, and the metropolis of the world assumed the aspect of a graveyard. The cause of the conflagration is involved in mystery. Public rumor traced it to Nero, who wished to enjoy the lurid spectacle of burning Troy and to gratify his ambition to rebuild Rome on a more magnificent scale and to call it Neropolis. When the fire broke out, he was on the seashore at Antium. Today we call it Anzio. Anzio and Antium are one and the same, but he was born in Antium, his birthplace. He returned when the devouring element reached his own palace and made extraordinary efforts to stay and then to repair the disaster by a reconstruction which continued until after his death. Now, continue. To divert himself from the general suspicion of incendiarism, and at the same time to furnish newest entertainments for his diabolical cruelty, Nero wickedly cast the blame upon the hated Christians, who meanwhile, especially since the public trial of Paul and his successful labors in Rome, had come to be distinguished from the Jews as a third class, or as the most dangerous offshoot from that race or from the Jews. They were certainly despisers of Roman gods, and that's true of the Christians. They despised Roman gods. And loyal subjects of a higher king than Caesar, and that's true. and they were falsely suspected of secret crimes. The police and people, under the influence of the panic created by the awful calamity, were ready to believe the worst slanders and abandoned victims. What could be expected of the ignorant multitude when even such cultivated Romans as Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny stigmatized Christianity as a vulgar and pestiferous superstition? It appeared to them even worse than Judaism, which at least was an ancient national religion, while Christianity was novel, new, detached from any particular nationality, which is true, and aiming at universal dominion, because not only Jews were converted, but Gentiles as well. Some Christians were arrested, confessed their faith, true Christians, because they confessed their faith, they didn't deny, and were convicted, not so much, says Tacitus, of the crime of incendiarism, as of hating the human race, which can be construed. Their Jewish origin, their indifference to politics and public affairs, because they didn't get involved in politics or public affairs, their abhorrence of heathen customs, also true, were construed into an odium generis humani, hating of the human race. And this made an attempt on their part to destroy the city sufficiently plausible to justify a verdict of guilty because of their beliefs. And guess what? One of these days, you, because of your beliefs, are going to be turned in by friends and family and relatives as well. An infuriated mob does not stop to reason and is apt to run mad at an individual. Under this wanton charge of incendiarism, backed by the equally groundless charge of misanthropy, hating of the human race, or hating of mankind, and unnatural vice, there began a carnival of blood such as even heathen Rome never saw before or since. A vast multitude of Christians was put to death in the most shocking manner. Some were crucified, probably in mockery of the punishment of Christ. Some sewed up in skins of wild animals, wild beasts, and exposed to the voracity of mad dogs in the arena. So besides being crucified, they were sewn up in skins and then cast into the arena for dogs to attack. The satanic tragedy reached its climax at night in the imperial gardens on the slope of the Vatican Hill. Christian men and women, covered with pitch or oil or resin, nailed to posts of pine, were lighted and burned as torches for the amusement of the mob, while Nero, in fantastical dress, figured in a horse race and displayed his art as a charioteer. Burning alive was the ordinary punishment of incendiaries, but only the cruel ingenuity of this imperial monster, under the inspiration of the devil, could invent such a horrible system of illumination. This describes the destruction of the Church of God at Rome in 64 AD, beginning at that time, the 10th year of Nero's reign. How long it lasted, did not study into that, but it began at that time. Though he may have had the fire started by his own command, he blamed it on the Christians. And the Christians who suffered and died were those who confessed that they were Christian. They acknowledged their faith in Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And they were slaughtered, decimated to extinction. Simon's followers, his brand of Christianity, did not suffer as much, if at all, because in practice they looked more like pagan Romans than they did Christians. As a result, the true Christians were decimated. The brand of Christianity that remained was Simon's brand. It was his brand of Christianity that took root in Rome and then grew from there. More as we go on.